then I look at you, and the world's all right with me. Just one look at you, and I know it's gonna be a lovely day. Thursday, y'all. This is Babs Rawls Ivy. And you know, if it's around 9 o'clock, it's time for Love Babs Love Talk. And today, I'm not spinning any music. I'm talking. And guess who's in the studio with me today? I have Gorman Bichard. And we are talking the New Haven Documentary Film Festival. Or Film Festival Documentary.
Yeah, you got it right the first time.
All right.
Yeah.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I hear such good things about you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I hope some of them are true, at least.
So tell me about this film festival, this documentary, and how old is it?
This is our fifth year. We started 5 years ago. It's an odd story. So my wife runs Willoughby's.
And, oh, does she?
Yes. And
we love Willoughby's.
So do I. That's what's in this cup right now. And my partner in the festival, Charles Musser, is a Yale professor who drank coffee there for 20 years. Where do I meet him for the first time? Missoula, Montana. I knew it was on your lips. I could see. I know you were going to guess that.
I was
that.
Like, oh yeah, you were in Willoughby's one day, and boom.
No, and so we meet there for the first time with two other New Haven filmmakers. This is 2014, and we realize filmmakers are not really having much of a chance to meet and greet in New Haven. So we brought our four films back. Charlie said, "Let's play them here at Yale." We did, and then the other two filmmakers ended up moving to Arizona. So Charlie and I said, that was fun. Why don't we actually try a film festival next year? We did 4 days in 2015. And then somehow we came up with this crazy idea to let's do 11 days.
Wow.
And it's stuck at 11 days. But every year it's more and more films. Like this year, for the first time on a number of nights, we have consecutive films playing in two different venues.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, so now you're trying to make it hard for people to choose.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we want, But we also play things that are very different. So, you know, we played the very hard-hitting film about refugees against, you know, a fun film about, you know, miniature golf. So.
Okay. All right. So the film festival is becoming quite the respected venue for filmmakers.
Oh, absolutely.
And so you have no shortage of people who are wanting to get in. So what's that like?
Well, we first off really try to focus on Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York, Massachusetts.
Oh, so you do limit. You do limit
we
it.
We limit up to a point, but then we start inviting people from outside when we love other films. Like I was just at a film festival with one of my films a couple of weeks ago, and I saw two short films that I thought were amazing. And I immediately just went up to the filmmakers and said, here's my card. I want this in our festival. And
so is that in the amazing category of the film festival?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, I think all of our films are very good to great, and it really depends on what you're into. I mean, we have something for everybody at this festival this year, from really hard-hitting look at things like refugees four young boys that were, because of the color of their skin, were given like ridiculous prison terms, to really light stuff like a film about miniature golf courses, or a film about this wonderful the Santa Claus village called North Pole, New York, which is the oldest theme park still existing in the country. And it's just one of these little crazy places that's like the North Pole. And you go there at Christmas time and kids can sit on Santa's lap and there's little silly rides. But it's so antiquated but still so beautiful, and it's holding on to the past.
Wow. So how many films in total this year?
A little over 80.
80?
Yeah.
80 films, 11 days.
Yep.
Now, do people get prizes if they see every single film? There's no way, right?
There's no way to do it. Yeah, you'd have to split yourself in half. Though we do, it's funny because we have an award ceremony on the second to the last night, the Saturday night, where we give the audience award for the best feature and for the best short. But we're also giving awards to the actual audience. So if you're there that night, we have all of these great prizes from local merchants, and we're going to be like just giving them away to people in the audience.
Oh, I'm coming.
You know,
because I like prizes. All right, so listen, let's back up a little bit.
Okay.
Let's talk about your history. Let's talk about how you got here. Because you wrote books, mm-hmm. you made films, left filmmaking, wrote more books, and then got the documentary bug.
I got back into filmmaking, and this documentary about my favorite band, The Replacements, this punk band from the 80s, fell into my lap, and I just love doing it. I love the idea that you're going in to interview someone and you never know what you're going to get. So you don't really have a script beforehand. In your mind, you think you know where the story is going, but someone can say something in an interview and change your entire film, you know,
but that's the beauty of a documentary because it's really unscripted and you're not trying to make people hit the marks and they don't have to memorize lines. They just show up and tell their story.
Right. And it's up to me to then weave all of these like narratives into one cohesive story, telling the greater picture. And I just love it. It's sort of editing a documentary is almost like writing a book. I feel.
And you've written how many? Four or five?
Five books.
Okay.
Yeah. And I feel that it's just it really is. It's just this great way of telling a story. And you can also do so. Like one of the films that I have two films in the festival this year, including opening night, which is Pizza Love Story about our three famous,
about the Holy Trinity.
The Holy Trinity: Sally's, Pepe's, and Modern. And but I mean, I go back to
no Bumantes.
We don't talk about other pizza
all right,
places.
But
I go back to the 1800s when Sergeant Locke Company was bringing the Italians over and settling them, you know, right around the factory, which basically becomes Worcester Square.
Worcester Square.
Yeah. And, you know, and so we really take a hard look at the entire history of the city as well, including the issues the city had in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and even 80s, you know, and how yet somehow these three pizza places survived.
Well, you know, that I read somewhere, Gorman, that pizza houses are thriving in unstable economic times.
Mm-hmm.
It's still one of the most affordable takeout kinds of things that you can get.
Well, I think that's one of the things you found back in the day, because these places were thriving back then because you had all of these immigrant workers that were poor, and most of the places were in the poorer neighborhoods. And, you know, you could go in and, I mean, I have a menu from Sally's, you know, a pie is 25 cents.
Now, do you feel like you're a pie aficionado? I mean, if you make a documentary, do you feel like you're an expert?
I feel I am one of the foremost pizza snobs on the face of the planet.
Yes,
I know everything.
We
had
a conversation earlier. And you
I know everything
that.
About pizza, and anyone who disagrees with me is just wrong.
Are you eating pizza with gold flakes?
No. I'm a purist. I like my pizza pretty much plain.
Because you know they do the pizza with the gold flakes.
I remember reading about
and
that.
Truffles like, and yeah, like no. millions of dollars of things on these pizzas.
Yeah, I'll maybe take you know like a smidge of hot cherry peppers every once in a while, but give me if you can't make a great cheese pie, just an old-fashioned cheese pie, you shouldn't be making pizza.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And or in case of Sally's, the Sally's plain, which doesn't have mozzarella, just has grated Romano on top. That's like a gift from heaven. I don't even know. You look at this and it's like, this can't be this good. And you take a bite of it and your eyes roll back into your head. And all of a sudden you see like God and visions in front of you. And you're like, it's maybe there's drugs on it. Maybe realize.
What does the Holy Trinity think of this documentary? Have they seen it?
Oh, they haven't seen it yet. No.
It's still
because this is going to be a work in progress, actually, that we're showing. We've been working on this film for 10 years. It's the only film that's ever taken me it's the only thing that's ever taken me anywhere near this long. And our notes literally date back to 2008, I believe. Or 2007, actually, Dean was saying. He's my co-producer. And we are going to be showing a work in progress. So see, because we're too close to it at this point, and we're going to actually sit with the audience afterwards and let people say what works, what doesn't, so we can really take notes and then really fine tune it and then put it out there for the general public.
And what's your second film?
The other film I have in this festival is my fifth music documentary on a that I originally started making it on an unsigned band down in North Carolina that I loved. And I loved them so much, I made a music video saying, hey, you guys need more fans. I'm going to do a free music video. I ended up getting Rolling Stone to premiere it. And next thing I know, my unsigned band gets a 4-record deal.
Get out of here. What's the band?
The band is Sarah Shook and the Disarmers. And they are just like this kick-ass alt-country band. I mean, and it's just a female-fronted band with these great freaking musicians behind it. And everything about them is great.
So is music your thing, too?
Oh, yeah. Music is my... is the passion that I sort of like, that sort of like keeps me going. I mean, rock and roll to me is sort of like the blood that's like cursing through my veins.
Are you a musician?
No, not really. I mean, I have a guitarist in my office, but I just make noise.
Do you sing?
No.
So if you could make a documentary of any musician dead or alive, who would you pick?
Ooh,
dead. Three. Give me three.
Wow, that's that haven't been done, or I don't care if there's already been one done.
Don't care if it's already been done.
Well, Bowie. Would be one.
Really?
Yeah, Bowie. Bowie would be very high up there. Elvis Costello, because it's never been done.
No?
No.
All this time?
Believe it or not, yeah, believe it or not.
Is he shy? Do you know anything about him?
I've seen him probably 60 times, but I don't, I mean, I don't know much about him beyond what the average person reads.
Maybe you could approach him.
You know, and then who else? I mean, my God. You know, The Clash would be very much very high up there.
Really?
Yeah, I'm an old punk from.
I see. I see the choices. Yeah. I see. All right. So this film festival was chock full of all kinds of things, and so what was the expectation when you got together with your other filmmaker friends and you said, mm-hmm. you know what, we could do this documentary thing in New Haven? Did you feel like New Haven was the place? Did you feel like New Haven needed something like this? Because New Haven is quite an artsy town on a lot of levels.
It is, but there's no film community, so to speak. I mean, and the filmmakers, having been making films, I've been making films in Connecticut since 1983, and there is no communication, or was no communication between filmmakers.
Why is that?
I honestly don't know. And because I would always see, it's like, oh, there's someone's having a film commission and they're inviting all these filmmakers. And I'd look and it's like, well, this guy made one movie. This guy made one movie. And I'd look and I was like, well, I've made eight. But you know, there's no communicate, you know, and it's one of those things where it's like, there were a couple of small little groups. And so I think that we sort of started it to really help the community itself. And also to get the community exposure. Because, I mean, there are a lot of great films being made here, and I think people don't realize that.
I think so. Does the Yale School of Film have any influence?
My co-director on the festival is Charles Musser from the Yale Film School.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like we really do sort of push it. It's town and gown. I'm obviously the old towny punk covered in tattoos, and he's very much the Yaley. But I think we work really well together. It's a good mix, and so we bring in both sides of the city.
Okay, because the music scene seems to be growing too. So you must have some interest in this great music scene that's happening under wraps and under covers in this city.
The funny thing is, it's like most of the music that I've never the pizza movie is the only local film I've done. All of the music stuff is. I seem to have more interest in the music scene in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Really?
Believe it or not. Yeah, that's where...
Are they doing cool stuff there?
Well, it's just a band. I mean, like, two of the documentaries out of five are from Chapel Hill bands. And Lydia Lovelace, one of my other... She was from Columbus. She moves to Chapel Hill. So three of my documentary subjects that in music are all in Chapel Hill.
Now, do you live here in Connecticut?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, I know. I've lived here my whole life. Grew up in Waterbury and moved to this area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you live in New Haven proper?
No, Hamden.
Okay.
But it's like it's the old joke about Hamden. It's like, where do you live, New Haven? Where do you go to dinner? Where do you go to dinner in Hamden, New Haven? Yeah.
All right. So what's the goal for the? Tell me. Have you seen all the films?
I haven't seen. Charlie brought in a few films that I have not seen, and I brought in films that he hasn't seen. So, no, I haven't seen every single film, but majority of them.
What makes a good film? What makes a good documentary?
The ability to tell a story.
Yeah.
Because that's the problem a lot of days with cameras have gotten cheaper and stuff. And especially with music docs, fans of a band who have no idea how to tell a story will go and say, oh, my band needs a documentary about them. And they'll make the documentary. And it's just, there's no narrative three-act structure. There's no arc. And that's what's missing a lot. So I think that storytelling is the most important part. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'll take storytelling over good camera work or anything.
Really?
You know, yeah. Cause I think if the camera work is amazing, but the story is horrible and the sound is horrible,
It doesn't matter.
In fact, when I teach panels on filmmaking, I'll always say sound is more important than camera. Because especially in a documentary, you can always cover it with a picture of something, what they're talking about. But if you have horrible sound that's noisy and you hear, you know, generators and trucks backing up and stuff, that just doesn't work. Go for sound.
What's your do you have a favorite so far?
In the festival?
Yeah.
Wow.
Not yours, but...
No, obviously. yeah, I mean, I have a couple. I love the one about the Santa Claus Village. We have one on... I like fun documentaries. We have one on miniature golf, which I love. We have one on a internet star, or a guy who tried for 30 years to be an internet star and never succeeded. I mean,
what do you mean an internet star?
He's been making videos and putting them on YouTube forever. But he always just wanted to go viral, and he never did. But he keeps doing it, and it's just it's
that's gonna go viral.
It's kind of funny. We have This Is Home, which was one of the Sundance Award winners, which is about Syrian refugees, which definitely plays into New Haven.
Yeah.
It's just this amazing collection. We have three films on food besides mine. We have Jim O'Connor on three films on New Haven. We have mine plus Jim O'Connor's Family Meal, which looks at three restaurants in town and the balancing act between home life and family life. And we have Steve Hamm's History of Worcester Square.
Oh.
So, yeah, there's a lot of local. We have an amazing film that features a lot of John Waters because he's very funny. But it's called Sickies Making Films, and it's about censorship in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And the shorts. We have really a lot of great shorts, including a student competition with 11 films, and they range from the Yaleys, who have a couple of films in there, to I have a middle school student in East Lyme who has a film that's playing right with the Yale students.
Nice.
Yep.
Nice. So what do you think about this filmmaking that we know of today? I mean, the equipment is lighter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more people can do it.
Yep.
I mean, I saw a thing where people were making films with their cell phones, their smartphones.
Yeah.
The quality is looking good. And
yeah, I mean, I think it's the only thing I would say to any filmmakers. Well, for one, come to our panels. We do panels on filmmaking.
Oh, okay.
They're
That's
free,
good to know.
The Saturday and Sunday mornings. But I would say that watch other movies and that dissect the way the story is being told. Look mm-hmm. at that three-act structure. The three-act structure, it goes back to Shakespeare, and it's been around forever for a reason. You can't really look at any film that's successfully been made and not see the three-act structure.
So what do you want this film festival to do for these filmmakers, maybe for New Haven? Is there some thought to that?
I mean, ultimately, I think New Haven is starving for the film culture in New Haven is starving, and I think we want to feed it and show that it's vibrant and not only connect the filmmakers with audiences, but connect audiences with films they might never, ever have a chance to see.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
A lot of films at festivals never get distribution.
I was a jurist on the Yale Environmental Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched, I don't know how many films I watched over a couple of days. And I was blown away at all the kinds of environmental films that existed. And I learned so much. Freaked me out how much I learned. Because, you just think you know everything. But
yep.
I learned so much, and I left feeling like, oh, my God, I'm a new fan of these kinds of films because I learned something, and they told compelling stories.
The thing is, we're so used to news clips and sound bites, three-minute packets,
yeah.
That you'll see on the news. And here you can take that same story and make it into 90 minutes and really give you the detail and the nuance as to why this is important.
Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about you used to make horror films.
Yes. Yes, I did. Back in the 80s, I made a couple of horror films. Probably the best known one is a film called Psychos in Love, which has a life that I can't almost believe. I mean, we just played, it was just screened in Brooklyn. It's the film is over 30 years old now. It was made in 86. It was just screened in Brooklyn to a sold-out audience. We just had last September. It was re-released on Blu-ray with 10 hours of extras.
Really?
Yeah, it's. I mean, someone turned it into a musical at this theater group in Wisconsin.
Are you flattered by that?
It's weird. You know, I mean, it was like, so I remember that they contacted me and said they wanted to do it. And I'm thinking, yeah, sure, it's never happened. Go, yeah, you can have the rights, no worries. And then next thing I know, I'm flying to, you know, Madison, Wisconsin, and watching this, you know. And then there are fans that came in from all over the country to
so
see
it has
the
its
musical.
Own cult kind of thing.
Oh, it's got it. Yeah, I guess there was even a drinking game at UConn back in the late 80s where every time the word grapes was mentioned. My killers in the film only kill people who like grapes. So anyway, it's a comedy. Remember that. It's a horror comedy. And anytime the word grapes was mentioned, you'd do a shot. So,
oh, yeah. My goodness.
I mean, I had someone come up to me at a screening and said, I've watched it over 100 times. And I'm
really?
Thinking, yeah. Yeah. So it's a little odd.
Did you, now, what was it about horror films that drew you to that genre?
I don't know. I was young and I, you know, it just... It was the horror film scene was really just exploding back in the early 80s,
yeah.
You know, with Friday the 13th and Halloween.
Oh my
and
God.
All those other ones. And
yes.
I also realized that I could do them on a lower budget. So that was a big thing, you mm-hmm. know, and you could do horror films with an unknown cast. So, because you were mainly going to kill everybody. So.
And so you left that.
Yep.
Why?
Really bad experiences with distributors who were just too sleazy for words.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Psychos in Love, you know, at one point, I guess, was one of the best-selling titles. The second best-selling title my distributor had that year. We never saw a dime.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, so it got to the point where it's like, you know, you're doing it for nothing. And then distributors, with later films, I don't even put on my resume. They, you know, they were just changing things without even asking. And I'm like, I can't deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
So I had an idea for a book, and I wrote my first book, Second Greatest Story Ever Told. We sold the movie rights, and I spent almost the entire decade of the 90s writing scripts, optioning the Hollywood, selling the movie. That movie rights to that book sold 6 times. No one ever made it into a film. And then I started after 10 years of that. I'm like, it's frustrating because no one – I have this job, but it's like – nothing gets made. Hollywood just spends money for
that's
no
like,
reason.
Talk to me about that Hollywood experience.
It's,
I mean, did you go there very hopeful and just like excited or and then it sort of jaded you or changed you?
Probably a little hopeful at the beginning. And then you start realizing that the majority of the people giving you notes are idiots and have no, you know, they're basically business manager, biz, you know, school of business students who are all of a sudden telling you what your story should be.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess maybe I don't have much tolerance for that. So, yeah. And so when it came around to the cameras were redesigned in the early 2002, 2003, I decided I was going to try it one more time where I was going to do my own film completely by myself, have 100% say. And I was either going to get that out of my system and go back to writing if it failed, or I was going to play film festivals and do well, and I was going to move on with that. And that film was actually called You Are Alone, and it was a very dark drama that we shot almost entirely at the old Hotel Duncan. On
really?
Street. Yeah.
Oh, that must be something to see.
Yeah, it's very dark.
Okay.
Very dark.
Yeah. Now, so what do you prefer? Do you prefer the dark?
What do I prefer?
The macabre? The
No, I probably prefer... documentaries and just finding interesting stories. I mean, I've done the music docs. I did an animal rights documentary called A Dog Named Gucci, and we're doing another one now called Seniors about senior dogs. And there's actually a senior retirement home for dogs in that, right outside
Are
of
you
Nashville.
Kidding?
No, it's the coolest place on the planet. Remember the eclipse in last summer?
Uh-huh.
I was there watching the eclipse with 115 elderly dogs.
Oh God.
It's the coolest thing in the world.
Really?
Especially with they're all looking up with their glasses. No, I'm just kidding. That would have been great. That would have been great. But I have the entire eclipse filmed for with all these cameras and the dogs just running around. But there's no cages in this place. It's like every dog has its own little apartment. Like the small dogs have little baby couches.
So why would a dog go there?
That's basically
not, I don't know if they choose that, but Somebody has to put them there.
Someone dies. An elderly person dies. No one wants their elderly dog. The dog would normally go to a shelter and be put to sleep because no one adopts elderly dogs because they want puppies. Not realizing that this dog is going to give you a few great years and it's trained and it's got a personality and it's like bringing in a new best friend where a puppy can be a pain for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And so these people take these dogs in. And not only that, they will foster them out and pay the medical bills for the rest of the dog's life. It's an amazing place.
Really?
Yeah.
So now people pitching you stories?
No, not really. I usually find people like,
hey, Gorman. Yeah.
What they do? They'll
can you make
like,
this for us?
They'll always suggest music docs. And for me, if I'm doing a music doc, it's got to be someone I'm in love with.
Yes.
Because I'd be putting a gun to my head. Like my
like you wouldn't do Beyonce right now.
I'm not into Beyonce. I'm just not. You know?
So you have to have some kind of real
like my
connection
brother-in-law
or a personality
says,
to it.
Yeah, my brother-in-law always says, make a Van Halen doc. And I'm like,
I don't like
first.
Van Halen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got to be someone that because you're living with this music for a year or two. And you hear these songs over and over again. It's got to be something that I really just love.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So nobody's pitching you film stuff?
No. It's like, and then, you know, the other things we're doing, obviously we're doing the pizza doc. I'm doing a sixth music doc. And we're also doing one, we're doing a heavy one on this horrible case of LGBT bullying in Minnesota where 9 kids in 1 school district committed suicide because of bullying.
What?
Yeah, over the course of 15 months. And
oh my gosh.
Yeah, so that's a heavier.
That's heavy. So how do you do that? How do you do that?
That one.
And how do you take care of yourself?
You cry a lot. I mean, there were scenes in that film where you're just, you know, at the end of the night, the whole crew just. I always treat my crew really well, go for a nice dinner. We would go, there was a sushi restaurant next to the hotel, and we would all go there and just drink and eat sushi. And because it was heavy.
Yeah, because you got to get in with the families.
Yeah.
And they each have their own story. And. Yeah. And awareness of things.
I mean, that happened in the Gucci film, the dog film. Here, the Gucci film in a nutshell is about a dog from Alabama. In the long story short, 15-year-old runaway has a dog. There's a number of drug dealers in town who she's sort of hanging with the wrong crowd. They want more from her than she's willing to give. She says no. To teach her a lesson, they snatch up her little 10-week-old dog. String it up, feed it, squirt it with lighter fluid, set it on fire.
Are you kidding?
No. Now, this should have been the end of the story. And we're talking, you know, a dog that's, you know, 10 weeks old is this big. And a college professor, 58-year-old college professor, is standing on his porch a couple doors down, sees it, chases the guys away, saves the dog. And when the kids just get a slap on the wrist, the dog lives. The dog lives for 16 years, becomes the face of animal abuse in the South. And they changed the law in Alabama to become a felony offense if you do something like that. And it was even named the Gucci Law. So, I mean, it was this real, it's a story about how one person can really make a difference and change a law.
Yeah.
You know, and
I had no idea that.
Yeah. It's a great story. It's called A Dog Named Gucci. If you have Amazon streaming, you can watch it.
Okay.
But in that story, there are 3 other little stories about other dogs that also were abused and had a law named after them. And one of them is this dog named Nitro. And Nitro was, his owners had put Nitro to be trained by this really well-known animal trainer. I mean, cover of animal magazines, did dogs for police, you know, for canine units, for special needs people. Really well-known. Well, guy went off the deep end and let 19 dogs basically starve and die in his backyard. And so I'm interviewing the woman who owned the dog, and she's telling her story very good. She started his foundation, everything. She's very cut and dry. And she's like, you want to interview my husband? And I'm like, sure, I will always interview him. And honestly, her husband looks like an extra from The Sopranos. No joke. I mean, and he comes and sits down, and he starts talking about they're bringing the body bag out from the freezer, and his 120-pound dog is 40 pounds and shriveled and frozen there. He starts crying. And we so did not expect it from this guy. And and this changed the whole movie because now became the point of the movie that I'm building to because I put this point, this is at like the end of the second act in the film. And I'll watch it in a theater with people and I have the entire audience sobbing. And you've not cried yet. Even though the abuse is talked about, this is when I get you by the throat. And it was because of this guy that I didn't even plan on interviewing. That's why I love documentaries. You don't know what's going to happen.
Wow.
And this man who you, I mean, he starts talking and you are so not expecting where he's going to take you and how emotional he gets.
So do you already have in your mind the next several documentaries you want to make?
Yeah.
Can you share a little bit?
Oh, well, the ones right now, we're finishing, like I said, the pizza one. We're showing a rough cut of the pizza one at the festival. Over the summer, I'm editing Seniors, which is the senior dog one, and a new music doc on a guy who was in one of my favorite bands, Wilco, who...
Yeah.
Jay Bennett. He was on the three Wilco albums that everyone basically loves the most, the second, third, and fourth. And he basically got booted from the band, and then he dies.
What?
Yeah, he dies a tragic death because he had hip problems and he was self-medicating with a patch and the patch went bonkers and he died in his sleep.
There's a lot of that. Yeah. Like Prince and...
Self-medicating. Fentanyl is not a good thing.
Yeah.
And it's just a tragic, beautiful story. But one of the cool things we found 5 hours of interviews with him that no one had ever heard before when he was in the band, right after he was booted, and a couple of years later. So it sort of tells his story through his own voice.
Wow, that's interesting.
And then Normal Valid Lives. And then, you know, there's a couple, I can't really talk about them yet because we haven't really signed on anything yet.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Do you know John Lucas?
Yeah.
Cooler Bandits?
Yeah, that's playing at our festival.
Oh, good, because I had him on a few months ago when he premiered it at Yale. Mm-hmm. Showed it at Yale and then a couple of schools around town.
Yeah. We were actually, he was sitting right next to dinner with me at Zinc while the movie was playing.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. And, yes. And you know, his wife, Claudia Rankin, is the MacArthur Fellow and Yale teacher. So anyway, he talks about how he got into this film. It was so personal to him. Like he knew these kids.
Mm-hmm.
Like he spent a lot of time with them and he just felt like he was called to tell this story. I mean, do you feel that way too about the things that you do? Do you feel like it's uniquely, it's that you're the voice or the person to sort of tell these stories because you're called to do it?
Yes, because especially with the music stuff, I feel that it's like I'm doing the bands that other people are ignoring, but their stories need to be told. And it's weird how I will get like people thanking me for like preserving their favorite band in one way. And in terms of like the animal stuff, absolutely, because it's like after we had made three... We made the animal one after I made three music docs. And it was my wife and I both have, we don't have kids, we have dogs. Love dogs. And it was just, we would always
so
see
this was very personal
stories.
To you.
It was ridiculously personal.
Okay.
I mean, I look for stories that really mean something to me that I think can either preserve a great artist that needs to be seen or make a difference in the world. You know, and with Gucci, to me, if one person watches that and says, you know, I can make a difference. Or so I watches Seniors and says, I will adopt a senior dog. That's now made it worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Okay, so if people want to know about these films, NHDocs.
NHDocs.com.
And the festival is from May 31st through June 10th.
Correct. Right here. It's and admission's free.
Oh, yes. And admission is free.
Admission's free. You can't beat that price.
Now, where are you showing these films?
They're mainly at the Whitney Humanities Center, 53 Wall Street.
Yes. I know that space.
We have that space, and there's also a space in there upstairs. So we have two venues there. We're also doing the New Haven Free Public Library on Elm Street.
Yeah.
And we have one screening, one of my rock doc this year at the Sarah Shook one at Cafe 9.
And so you're having panels.
We're also having a panel. We have a panel on Kickstarter. So if someone wanted to raise money to do their own film, we have a couple of people talking about Kickstarter.
Is it expensive to make films these days?
It depends on what film you're making.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I'm doing a film, the majority of the expenses goes into travel to go in and actually shoot the film. And then the post-production, like sound mix and insurance and things like that.
Okay.
But again, that's documentaries. To make other films, I'm sort of removed from that. The last narrative film I made, I actually shot it as a documentary. I knew I had an actress that I really liked working with. I said, this is the story we're going to tell. This is how it starts. This is how it ends. We're going to figure out the middle as we get there.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
And we did. It's funny. It's my wife's favorite film that I've made. It's called Broken Side of Time. But it's very dark.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, a lot of it was shot at the Duncan. You know, and uh, But yeah, it was almost all ad-libbed.
So Kickstarter, what are the other panels?
The other panel, we always have two. The one panel is Kickstarter, and the other one is the art of interviewing. Because I find a lot of people don't really know how to interview someone for a documentary. You know, what are the secrets to, like, really getting that great moment?
And you're giving this away for free?
I'm giving it away for free. And then we also have another one on the following weekend on the art of the documentary. So,
oh.
Yeah.
Now, do you ever think about Oscar?
No. No. No.
It's, never?
No, I think that, like, a lot of that is just, you know, it's like popularity contest kind of things.
Uh-huh.
I don't know that my subjects, for the most part, are big enough. You know, I mean, and especially with documentary, Oscar is weird.
But have you submitted?
No. No, because you have to play theatrical in New York and L.A. for a week.
Which costs
the I know people who've done that, and you can literally pay to play in New York and L.A. for a week each. And basically all the money they would have made on the documentary went into that, and they basically lost everything.
Oh.
Yeah, it doesn't end up being
painful.
Yeah, it doesn't end up being worth it unless, you know, if you have someone who picks up your film and pays for it, you know, if HBO buys your film or Netflix buys your film and wants to open theatrically, my God, go for it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to do it out of pocket, you know, save that $40,000 and make another film or go on a really nice vacation, you know.
Do you think you have another book in you?
There's one that we're actually shopping around.
Really?
Yeah, but yeah, and I like telling stories. It's funny for me. The books and writing is something I just sort of do in my spare time when I'm not making five films at all at once and running a film festival.
How do you find the time to do all this stuff?
I don't sleep. I realize that. I really don't sleep. And yeah,
Are you equally enamored of both, or is there one greater than the other?
I like the film because it combines everything that I love. It combines music, it combines images, and it combines storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Though sometimes the book is nice to just sort of get away and get into your own head and just, you know, I can go and sit on the back deck with the dogs and the laptop. I don't need all this equipment, you know, like I'm too old and blind to edit on a laptop now. I need a monitor that's the size of, you know, a big screen TV, basically.
I understand that. I understand that. Listen, so what do you think New Haven needs to make this town a little bit more hospitable to filmmakers?
Wow. It needs to go back to a little bit more of the glory days of when the arts were thriving in New Haven in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
and stop being so corporate, stop turning the streets into an outdoor mall with big chains. I mean, I love towns that ban chains.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, you go to Asheville, North Carolina, you're not going
to. I love Asheville.
Oh, I love Asheville. You're not going to find a Starbucks in downtown Asheville.
Yeah.
You know, I know we couldn't do it, but imagine New Haven with just the cool, funky little New Haven stores that we used to have and the ones that we still have now that are you know, struggling, I think, to hold on. We need New Haven to bring its identity back and to stop trying to bring identity from outside places that really have nothing to do with New Haven.
Wow.
Keep the chains out. Let us be the people that we can be, because we have an amazing, diverse, talented city here. And it's like, and you've got people bringing in, you know, ridiculous stuff that we don't need. We don't need trailblazers. You know, you can go to the freaking mall in Milford. You know, it's like, you know, we need, you know, when I moved here, there were 7 record stores.
I know!
There is not one record store in New Haven.
And records are coming back.
You know, it's
or
like,
for some people, they ain't never left.
Yeah,
but
it's, you know, it's just, it's.
Well, yeah. You know, I'm a new board member of the Arts Council. I'm going to take some of this conversation back. As a matter of fact, when it becomes the podcast, I'm going to tag Dan Fitzmaurice in it so
Dan
he can listen.
Dan is actually doing one of our Q&As.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think he's got that kind of energy that you're talking about in seeing the arts community.
Yeah. It's
a
like,
little differently.
It's you know, it's like bring it back to like the grunginess and let us, you know.
Because it's too polished now,
yeah.
You think?
I mean,
too sharp.
But not only that, it's like, you know, you want to open a little store in New Haven.
You can't do it.
You can't afford to rent anymore.
Oh, no.
We're somehow now priced, you know, like, this is not Chapel Street is not Rodeo Drive.
Or Georgetown.
You know, yeah. You know, and it's still New Haven.
Yeah.
You know, and I think
you know what? You are right. That's a good thought.
Yeah. It's you know, I mean, you got people opening $4,000 apartments in New Haven. It's like, come on. Who can afford?
I don't know. But there's a market.
You're starting to see more empty storefronts now. And I think unfortunately, it's starting to go back downhill. And I don't know. I hope it lands in a good place.
Yeah.
Restaurants, a lot of restaurants have closed in the past year.
So you're paying attention to that. Do you think you're paying attention to it because you're a citizen, or are you paying attention to it because you are a filmmaker? Are you paying attention to it because...
Well, I mean, my wife owns two places downtown, or runs two places downtown, I should say. So, I mean, it's that.
It's very personal.
I mean, because, you know, I always hear her talking about the ups and downs of, mm-hmm. of business, you know. And Willoughby's has been around. Willoughby's was the first coffee shop in New Haven,
yeah.
you know. And
yeah.
it's been around forever. I mean, they must be going on 35 years, give or take,
mm-hmm.
you know. And, you know, still owned by Barry Levine and Roasting Beans and looking for great coffee everywhere. And she runs the retail aspect mm-hmm. of it. And
Do you think there's room for upstart? Well, I mean, Blue State is here.
There's room. I think
coffee peddler people.
Yeah, there's room for any of the small ones. Did we need another Starbucks on Church and Elm here?
Because they moved from. Because you know what that was about.
Well, it's unfortunately it's. Yeah,
you know what that's about.
Yeah, it's a lot about that. That's still a lot about what New Haven is.
They want a clientele, and they didn't want the other element of clientele. That's my take on it.
Why would you move
across the green? I mean, it's.
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
You know, that goes back to the whole mismanagement of the Ninth Square anyway, which is a whole other, that's a whole other story. I actually wrote a book called The Ninth Square.
Did you?
Yeah. And it was funny because out of nowhere, I get another Yale professor named Doug Ray, who wrote that amazing book called City about the whole urban rural thing.
Yes, yes.
He contacts my wife at Willoughby's and says, your husband wrote this book. I'd like to meet him. And he's sitting there talking with me and he's like, where did you get all of this information? And I'm like, it's fiction. I made it up. And he goes, and he literally said to me, it sounded like that I was in all of the meetings when they were developing the Ninth Square. And he said, because you got every single thing right, every mistake we made, you captured perfectly.
So do you feel political? I mean, do you feel the politics of things?
Because
you're very close. I mean, you're right on the cusp of.
You know, I pay attention to it, but I don't want to. It's like there's only so much one person can do, and it's like I'm if I'm going to use my voice, I'm going to use it through the films.
Okay,
and I'm not going to try to fight City Hall.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
that I think ultimately for me that's a losing battle, and I don't have enough energy left in. I think I actually prefer to fight for animal rights or the rights of kids being bullied or something like that is probably a little bit closer to the heart.
So as we wrap this up a little bit, so. Do you think you'll retire from making films, or do you think you'll make
the minute that they close the casket? I will be retired. That will be like, I'll probably still have my camera in my hand or my editing machine, you know, and you know, no, it's what I don't have to retire from what I do. That's the nice thing, you know, or writing. I mean, it's like it's just you do it until you drop dead and you knock the bourbon glass over and your dog starts howling, you know.
Well, I'm so looking forward to this film festival. I think it's going to be great. And so now, does everyone who submit a film, do they come into town for the...
We have filmmakers from every single film, pretty much, except for a couple of shorts.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things because it makes it special. I mean, if you're coming, you not only get to see the film, you get to hear the filmmaker talk and ask him questions.
Is there a party?
There are a lot of parties.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, I need to drink by this point.
All right. I have to get on this list so I could get invited. Can I get a press pass for some of these things?
I'm pretty sure you know someone who can get you into the opening night party there. In fact, the opening night party, you know, Sally's, Pepe's, and Modern is the food because that's the movie. So the opening night party, I think it's one of the few times ever, if not the first time, that all three pizzas will be served
in the same
location.
Place?
Think about that.
Oh, my God. Somebody better be taking pictures. This is because, you know, this Holy Trinity conversation is an international conversation.
Oh, yeah.
No matter where you go in the world, people will square up about what side are you on. Are you Team Pepe? Are you Team Sally? Are you Team Modern?
That's it. And it's funny because we even have Chris Murphy, our senator, is in the movie talking about it, and he's hysterical because he talks about, like, Chicago, that's a casserole. And he's like, he literally says, it's like, we make pizza that's horizontal.
I'm with him. That deep dish pizza.
No, it doesn't.
I was like, that is not pizza. No, that's a casserole.
Yeah, it's pizza pot pie is what I call it. Yeah, that doesn't count.
You have to have the thin crust. Yeah. You have to have, a little burnt
and
on
it's
it.
It's gotta be burnt.
That's
oh
right.
My God. Yeah. It's if your hands aren't dirty.
That's
when
it.
You're eating pizza.
That's it.
You haven't eaten pizza.
And I try to tell my friends all over the country, all over the world. And somebody will ask me, well, what team are you on? I was like, well, I'm on all teams, but because I can't have the cheese. But I know this. And I think Mr. Pepe told me this. He's like, listen, it's not about the cheese, the sauce. If you can't make a pizza without cheese on it, mm-hmm. you don't know how to make. You should be in the pizza business.
Well,
swear to God, that's what he said.
The original pizza places in New Haven. I mean, when you look, it says, if you look on Frank Pepe's menu, it says the original tomato pie. That was the first pie. All it was sauce on
some dough
on
the
dough,
bread,
but maybe
right.
just a you know, garlic or you know something like mm-hmm. that on it. And still at Sally's, that's their
yes,
signature
cause
pie.
Because that's the one I get when I go there.
And that's. You know, and you look at that, and it's like, I will always bring people from New York, from Chicago, from L.A., and they'll have this, and they look at it and go,
eh.
This can't be any good. And then they take a bite.
And they go, oh, my God.
And it's like, you know, like in the movies, you see when, like, someone's shooting up heroin, and their eyes roll back in their head, and they're just, like, floating. That's what it's like when you take that first bite.
That sounds about right.
Okay, now we got to go get pizza. Okay, it's 10 o'clock in the morning.
Are they open?
Pizza.
Are they open?
No.
Do they sell a morning
yet.
Pizza? No, it's too early. They're back there making the dough. So, oh my God, Gorman, it's such a pleasure to meet you and talk to you.
Nice to meet you,
I've enjoyed this. So listen, everybody who's listening, get the film festival starts next Thursday, a week from today, nhdocs.com. Go look at the list and pick your films. And go enjoy some films that you wouldn't see.
It's free.
And it's free. It's, you know, take a date.
Documentaries are the perfect date movies.
They are because it forces you to talk.
Yeah, and it actually does. It's
yes.
Because like, you walk out of there and it's like you've actually seen a real story. And again, go see the one about miniature golf. That's fun and light. You know, who doesn't love miniature golf?
And I bet you'll learn something that you didn't even know.
It's about the way the courses are designed, which is kind of crazy, you know.
I love it. I absolutely love it. Thank you so much. It's
been
my pleasure. I hope I see you at some of the festival stuff.
I am around. Trust me.
All right, Harry, I'm going to play us out.